between their meat people and the the research lab. And at that time, there was the meat farmers, the livestock farmers, were losing money, and they were mad as hell at Washington, and there was actually a march on Washington.
You mean by
the farm livestock?
Livestock producers?
Yeah, some association they had.
I can't imagine that there was a large proportion of Swiss business being taken away from them, was it? Had it grown?
No, but that's what what do they call it? Not their procurement department, but their animal relations department. they said if word ever gets out that you are working on a synthetic meat, you just wipe us out. So.
But of course, they were marketing it under another name, weren't they?
They were still in the laboratory.
It was still in the research stage.
Yeah. Okay. They had developed several products.
What kind?
Well, deviled ham was the outstanding one, I think.
Deviled ham?
They had
that's perfect.
A lot of visitors going through their meat plant in the old stockyards. And they give them snacks up in their lawyer and their foyer.
Uh-huh.
And they tested out their synthetic deviled ham against their real deviled ham.
Oh,
and we
God.
Could win every time.
Oh, my God. But, now, because of flavor?
Flavor, and we controlled the salt better and all
right.
that stuff.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And they had a couple other products, which were...
Do you remember what they were?
Well, bacon was one.
Bacon? Mm-hmm. You could make an imitation bacon that was better than the original?
Well, I won't say it was better, but it was acceptable.
Okay, good.
And ham was always quite easy to do, because the smoke dominates ham.
Smoke and a little salt.
And cloves.
And cloves, yeah. Okay. Now, wait a minute. I want to call you on that cloves business. You don't always get clove. In baked ham. Not everybody uses it.
There's a lot of spices you can use in ham.
Okay, good. Okay.
But their animal people went out, and so they decided to drop their option.
So this is I'm laughing, but it's very serious.
Yeah. Well, that opened up the U.S., Canada, and Mexico to new licensees.
They dropped your option. Or
Swift did.
Okay.
And so then I went to General Mills, and they took it up. They took a lot.
For what kind of a projection?
They developed, a very successful product called Baco's.
I remember Baco's. Bacon.
That's right. That's made out of my patent.
And are you still getting royalties?
No, the patent ran out in 71.
Oh, no. It wasn't renewable?
No, you can't renew a patent.
Oh, that's patent law. You can only go, 25 years?
17.
Oh, my God. So all these years you've been getting royalties, at least up to 71, on Baco's, which, of course, every salad bar in the universe uses the damn stuff.
I forgot. Worthington Foods also took a license.
Okay.
And
now, who are they?
They are this outfit in Columbus, Ohio, that Seventh-day Adventist people who never eat meat.
Right.
And they produce a line of products for this market.
Do you know that's why Dr. John Harvey Kellogg developed it?
Yeah.
Because the sanitarium was controlled by the Seventh-day Adventist.
That's right. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, very good.
But anyway, they got products on the market right away,
because
I didn't think they were very good, but their market wasn't very fussy.
Did you assist them in getting started?
Yeah,
I
set up a spinning plant.
Uh-huh.
We produced fiber, and then they put that fiber into their products and got it on the market.
That's
so
incredible.
They were paying royalties too.
That's incredible.
And Purina.
Now,
was
set the stage for Purina. They're a huge. St. Louis now a conglomerate, a cereal conglomerate, and also an animal feed.
Well, they dominate the animal feed market,
pet
food market.
The cereal's a side line, sort of.
Yeah, it's rather small, but.
Yeah. I remember eating hot Ralston when I was a kid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Their wheat checks and bran checks and
very
corn
good.
Checks are very, very,
very
good seller,
very good.
And they do a lot of brand manufacturing for other people.
For fiber?
For Kroger, for instance. They make Kroger's cornflakes and that kind of stuff.
They do? Okay, good.
But they were getting into the protein. They had bought from Procter & Gamble, Procter & Gamble's protein plant in Louisville, which was industrial protein for paper coating.
Why had Procter & Gamble given it up? They were
I don't know.
They were getting to another direction, perhaps.
I don't know why they
did. More consumer
but
the products.
Purina.
What year was this, by the way?
56, 7, or 8 in that area.
Good.
But Purina had bought that plant.
Ralston Purina.
Yeah, and decided that they also wanted to get into edible protein.
Where was the plant?
Louisville.
Louisville, okay. Mm.
And
they've been watching your work with
apparently, and but I went over to Purina out of a with no appointment or anything, and just out of a clear sky, and explained to them what I was trying to sell.
Had you heard of their interest?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd heard of it at Worthington Foods.
Okay.
Because Worthington wanted to find a source of protein, edible protein, because they were too small to make it themselves.
Okay, of course.
Yeah. And I went over to the Louisville plant to see if they would produce some protein according to our specification. And they
Louisville Procter & Gamble plant.
Well, it's
the
Purina.
Yeah. Okay.
The manager there said, well, we're not producing that right now, but he said, I think you ought to talk to our St. Louis people. So he set it up for me, and
good.
So they took a license for all remaining rights.
Which were
practically everything.
Practically the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
But not Unilever is still...
Unilever finally gave up on it.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Why?
Their peanut just didn't work out.
It didn't work out.
They finally dropped all.
So they dropped the option. So
yeah. They couldn't get soybeans over there economically.
Why?
They don't grow. No. They had
in North Africa, or here.
Well, in England or wherever.
Well, yeah. So by this time, so they dropped the option. So you had worldwide rights available for General Mills.
Yeah, and Purina.
And Purina, yeah. Okay, good.
And they, I went. I consulted with Purina then in Worthington Foods in Nabisco. I was consulting with all of these for a while.
Nabisco is General Motors product? No, that's National Biscuit.
They were interested in their product Milk Bone.
Oh yes, of course.
And,
the dog,
and they wanted to make casein fibers to put into dog food.
Okay.
So their field was very limited.
Casein from? Oh, what do you mean casein fibers? You mean
spin casein from like the Italians were doing.
Oh yeah, from milk products, yeah.
Yeah, but they wanted to make it edible.
Yeah.
So I went over and set up a plant for them.
Uh-huh. Where was that?
This was at their Fairlawn, New Jersey research lab. They had a big pile of plants.
Did they? Oh, great.
But then when I went to Purina.
What did you do for Nabisco? That was it?
Yeah, that's all.
Okay, fine. None of the consumer products?
No. It turned out that casein fiber was not economical to put in a dog food. It'd be all right for human food, but
why?
Well, it's too expensive.
Okay.
You have to use milk protein.
This is a low cost.
Yeah.
Product.
Milk bone is. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. But the dogs aren't very discerning. They just want something tough to exercise their teeth and gums on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why they wanted to put fiber in it.
Okay.
So to give it that.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
But anyway, Purina took the rest and asked me to come over and consult with them. Which I did for 2 years, and then they asked me to go on the payroll,
and
I did.
Now, what were you doing for them as a consultant? You were refining their...
I showed them how to spin fiber.
Spin protein.
And how to make the protein edible and all that.
Uh-huh. Now, what products did they utilize then?
Well, they have a very successful business now. They've got plants all over for producing it.
Well, they produce it in bulk.
Edible protein in
for
bulk.
For other producers.
Yeah.
Did they incorporate it in any of their consumer products?
No.
Or any of their animal feed.
They, again, have a conflict. They have to be very touchy and very careful about their big market is pet food people.
No, of course.
But they built these.
But what was the conflict?
Let me see. How did
ethical or a commercial conflict?
Commercial.
Okay.
Oh, their animal feed, which is a $600 million a year business.
Right. Made out of...
Grain
products.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if they were going to produce, say, synthetic meat ham, they would be in competition with animal producers, and they're very touchy about these markets.
Yeah, sure. No, I'm laughing, but it is very serious. Yeah.
But they've been very successful in their soy protein. They got a plant now in Belgium, three in this country, and they're building one in Russia, and they're going to go all over the world because it's the cheapest source of protein going, and the poor countries who are not sophisticated appetite people like we are
don't want to eat plain soybean.
No, yeah. are using it. They're mixing it in with other products.
Of course.
And they can't make enough of it right now. And that's why it's a good stock.
This is far beyond the soybean curd that we're getting in tofu. This is far more sophisticated.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
And they're mixing it with all sorts of... They're providing the protein content to a lot of low-cost edible foodstuffs.
Yeah, that goes into hot dogs and sausages and meat, mixed meat deals. The meat industry loves it.
Of course, it's an extender, right?
That's right.
And a source of protein.
And it improves the product. This is not
improves the consistency of the product. And the taste.
And that's going more and more into baking industry and breads and that sort of thing.
Now, had you envisioned this explosion?
Oh, yeah. We had a long time ago, yeah.
We? You?
Well, wherever I worked.
Yeah, okay,
I worked in so many research labs.
All right, but now you're in at the ground floor at Ralston Farina, and you've got a reasonably lucrative consulting contract, plus you're getting royalties from the world, from them, they in General. Did General Mills stay on?
Yeah, until the patent ran out. Then they were increasing, their royalties were growing very, they were nice.
Yes, and of course Ralston was too.
Yeah.
But you're there on a 3-month consulting card, and then Ralston Farina put you on the payroll.
They asked me to come on the payroll.
And did you? Accept?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Now, how many years did that?
9 and a half. Until I retired when I was in 71. When
the patent ran out.
Well, yeah, that was incidental, though.
That was not the reason.
No.
You felt you'd had enough. You had a very busy life.
Yeah, well, we'd gotten remarried, and we had a beautiful boat and all that sort of thing. We decided to enjoy it.
So, in 71, you're still getting patent royalties. No.
That's when they stopped. Yeah, that's
prior
when they
to 71, stopped. Maybe the 10 years before 71, you're getting patent royalties from Purina.
Worthington.
Worthington. Oh,
General
Worthington
Mills.
Continues. They're doing the vegetarian.
That's right.
Have they cornered that market by then?
Oh yeah, they're.
Because I can remember when I was a kid, even seeing the Battery Sanitarium products, and even later. In a very reduced form, still selling it.
Oh yeah, they're selling it.
Okay, and I'm sure there are other companies that do it too. But yeah. Worthington had the lock on
the sophisticated products.
Yeah. Of the vegetarian.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they're the only ones using fiber.
And then of course General Motors or General Motors, you became the General Motors of the cereal industry, I think. General Mills and Ralston Farina have the worldwide rights to your edible soybean. Process.
Well, of course, now there are no more rights. No more patent.
But you were getting patent royalties from them up through 1971.
Right. Very nice. Yeah.
And obviously, very very lucrative arrangement for you, mm-hmm. and very pleasant as
yeah.
well. You enjoyed your work.
Oh yeah.
They enjoyed having your expertise and your input.
It really was quite an unusual story because I would go from one research lab to another.
Mm-hmm.
Be right part of their basic crew and have it's access
marvelous.
To everything. It was. It
Did
was.
Worthington put you on the payroll?
No, just
the
as
consulting
a
fee,
just
no?
a consulting fee.
Okay, and General Mills was a consulting fee.
Right.
But you were on the payroll on the regular the research at payroll
Purina.
Of Ralston Purina.
Yeah.
That's marvelous.
And, but it's very unusual for a person to be able to go in and out of competing
yes.
research labs,
and
actually work on them.
But. Now, General Mills had no ethical or commercial. I mean, they had no commercial conflict, did they?
No,
because they weren't dealing in meat.
And they went all out on that Baco's product. It was very successful.
They
made a lot of money on it.
Do they still market it?
Yeah.
God, I've tried that stuff. It's.
There's a cheaper form of it now, made from extruded soy meal, which is not nearly as good.
No.
But it's cheaper.
It's cheaper. Mm-hmm. I've only seen it when. At Salad Bars.
Yeah. Well, that's where it went over real big, was in these dishes,
yes.
you know.
Right. That's incredible. Yeah.
Also,
spice companies,
McCormick has them.
McCormick has them. Who else?
Out in the West Coast, the big one out there.
Yeah, the one that has the really good spices.
Yeah, I forgot.
Old Spice. Spice Island.
Yeah.
Spice Island has marketed a Baco type, probably unlicensed from Ralston Farina.
Well,
for
it might be.
But they do their own.
Well, if there's a big patent fight going on now between Purina and a big farm cooperative who is infringing one of the patents, which is in my name, but it's signed to Purina.
Really?
In fact, I
testified. Did you have to sign over to many of those patents?
None of my own.
Oh.
But when I got one, well, I was working in another research lab, and they were paying costs,
yeah,
they got the patent.
Oh, they did.
But I maintained the...
You developed the Baco concept, then,
yeah,
under their direction.
Right. And they paid a royalty on that.
Oh, my gosh, marvelous.
But there's big patent suit that I testified in just about a little over a year ago.
Did you?
And Purina won it. So
did they?
It amounts to $8 million, something like that. It was pretty big.
Now, you mean a farm conglomerate? A farm product conglomerate was trying to set up a...
Farmore company. It's a big outfit. It's
Farmore?
I think that's the name of it.
F-A-R-M...
M-O-R.
M-O-R.
Something like that. But
they were trying to set up a competing...
they did. They were producing tons and tons of it.
A Baco type.
In spite of the fact that we accused them of infringing, and they went ahead anyway, so there was quite a big penalty. I haven't heard the details of the settlement.
Did you get an expert witness?
Yeah, that's what they called me.
Yeah, good. Okay. Well, that's fascinating. Gee, that's an incredible story. Now, here you are. It's been about 15 years since the royalty stopped. What have you been doing in the interim in this 15 years since you've been retired?
Traveling.
But I mean in terms of the industry.
I worked as a consultant for Worthington for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And
are they still in business?
Oh yeah, oh, they're very,
very big.
Very active. Uh-huh. Then Miles Laboratories bought them.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Now where are they based?
Elkhart, Indiana.
Oh, that's
but
right.
But they're a real old company, and
right,
they wanted
Old
to.
Line Pharmaceutical House. Yeah.
They wanted to get into soy protein apparently.
Uh huh.
And
to diversify.
Yeah, and so I. They asked me to consult.
Good.
With Worthington, using Worthington as a base.
Right.
And when I retired from Purina in 71, then I went as a consultant for Miles, but located at Worthington.
Right. How many years did that last?
Well, until about, it was about five or 6 years that I was, 6 years.
Was it enjoyable?
Oh, very much.
You could.
And they let me phase it out. I'd signed a contract for 9 months for the first year, 6 months. Four, three, and then one.
How many years did that run?
It took over. It took 6 years, really.
Oh, 6 years. Yeah. Now, what products did you come up? Did you and they come up with in that period? New products.
Miles. Just refinement of Worthington's products.
Well, that's right. They bought Worthington.
They bought Worthington, and they were refining it.
Uh-huh.
And they never quite knew what they wanted to do with it actually. They weren't sure that they should...
Well, the vegetarian market was expanding, wasn't it?
Yeah, they wanted to expand it. That's the way they finally did go, was to expand it and under Worthington label.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Then the German company, Bayer Aspirin,
yes,
came over from Germany and bought Miles.
Oh, did they?
And they terminated all the work on soybean.
Oh, why?
I don't know. They actually sold off Worthington. Worthington bought its own plant back again.
Oh, well, they did.
Yeah.
And now are they back in business?
Oh yeah, they're in. They never.
You mean Bayer Aspirin came over as a foreign conglomerate, bought Miles Laboratory, which had bought
Worthington.
Worthington.
And then there was a complete change of management.
Right. They kicked out the old Miles Laboratory executive level.
Right.
Brought in their own people.
And decided to get out of the.
And decided
protein
we don't
business.
Want any protein.
Right.
Why? That sounds.
Well,
incredible.
They're so involved in. In medicine, chemically,
yeah.
Chemical medicine.
Oh, so is Miles.
Yeah, but not...
Not to that extent.
Not to that extent.
Yeah, they're really monsters out there.
But, of course, Alka-Seltzer, which is their big product,
yeah.
Bayer's pushing that, of course. Miles is a very profitable company.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah. So
incredible. So there you were. Well, I don't know whether you're still on a consulting track.
No.
You finished that.
Yeah, well, then when my eyes really started getting bad about 4 or 5 years ago,
Did Worthington, after they reconstituted the company, they bought it back from Bayer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they went into business again as an independent company.
Well, yeah, but they decided to restrict their marketing to their vegetarian or Seventh-day Adventist group. They didn't.
Right. They didn't want
Miles tried for a while under the name of Morningstar Farm Products.
I remember that.
They pushed that pretty good. And as long as they were on TV and pushing it, yeah. It sold real well. But the minute they stopped advertising or pushing it, the sales dropped.
Well, there are other forms of advertising, print, radio,
well,
magazine.
Well, they tried most everything.
But it was TV that really got the market out.
Yeah. And their products weren't good enough. I never was happy with the quality. Well, I don't know. They always had to make some...
Cutting corners,
and when you go from laboratory to production, in the laboratory you can make a delicious ham.
You were not asked to follow the product through after it got out of the laboratory. In other words, you weren't asked to be a quality control man in production.
No.
So you couldn't affect that.
Well, they had their own committee. They'd decide on whether they wanted this formula or that formula in the product or whatever.
I see.
And they had a committee set up for that.
You were the chemist, not the production person. Mm. So they cut corners and they, in effect, adulterated their product.
Yeah, it just never quite took off. If they spent $50,000 a month, say in Florida, they could sell that much and break even, but
right.
They weren't making big.
On television spots.
Yeah. They weren't making big money.
Are they still in business?
Worthington?
Worthington?
Oh, yeah.
They're
growing.
Are they the only company doing the synthetic
in fiber
products?
In fiber work, yeah.
The only one?
In this country. Now, since the patents ran out, there are two companies in Holland. Well, there's two of them in Holland now, and then one in Japan that I know of, and I think one in Australia. And there probably be more that I don't know about, because they don't, they don't have to tell me what they're doing.
Do you follow the technical literature, the
mm-hmm.
trade literature?
Yeah.
And so you know exactly what's happening.
Well, pretty well.
Pretty well, yeah. Well, it's incredible. I just am aghast that no one's ever looked into this aspect of your career. Everybody assumes it stopped after the plastic car.
it really just got started.
Oh, you went on to incredible vistas after mm-hmm. that. Yeah. Well, is there anyone else like you in this country who is, obviously very few people came up through the same route you did, but are they carrying on obviously there are scientists who are working, trained in edible plastic technology, right?
I think so,
yeah. Are there schools of academic programs?
Michigan State has a very strong food technology department, and they keep following it.
Do they?
Amherst, or Massachusetts.
MIT?
Not MIT, but...
University of Massachusetts?
Yeah, it isn't Amherst though. There's another one out there. They've got a professor who's highly interested in it. And
okay.
MIT keeps an eye on it.
Uh-huh.
They have a pretty good flavor lab set up at MIT.
Oh, do they?
Oh yeah.
And that's of course the essence of much of it.
They can taste test new products
right.
and tell you what's wrong with them or
uh-huh.
what should
yeah.
be done and that sort of thing.
Yeah. You were thinking of Brandeis?
No.
No.
Well, I should know that.
You said Amherst. It wasn't Amherst.
No, I don't think it's Amherst.
It's a Massachusetts university.
Yeah,
in the western part
of the state.
It's not in the east part. It's the western part. Okay.
But I'm sure that there are a lot of private research labs, like, for instance, I'm pretty sure General Foods is quite active in it.
I'm sure.
And Procter & Gamble is a comer.
He's jumping back into it now.
Well, they never really got into it. They sold off their industrial protein.
That's right, yeah. Okay.
But they come out with a lot of new patents on protein structures.
Oh.
And, but...
Now, what commercial application have you seen of that activity?
Nothing that Procter & Gamble hasn't done anything commercial yet.
There's no consumer products. Knew that they've come up with.
No, the only thing you can find out about them is through their patent literature.
Oh, I see. They're very secret.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And most of the big companies are now.
Are they?
I don't think I could ever get a setup like I had before where I could work 3 months in one company and then go right to their competitor and work.
That's incredible.
It was...
You've got to write this up.
I'm going to.
Mr. Boyer, that's just an incredible story. You've got to really interest somebody into doing this. Because it's unique, is it not?
It is.
Your
yeah.
career is
yeah.
really unique.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people claim that, but it's really true with you.
This one thing, I'm always sorry that Henry Ford wasn't around
at
this stage.
You would have loved it.
Oh, I should say.
Oh.
I even went to the Ford Foundation in New York to see if, oh, this must have been about 10, 12 years ago, to see if they would be interested in a worldwide humanitarian type of product, because the African people are starving, you know.
Of course.
And so in mid-Central America, and I thought that it would be a natural for them to set up a research project in Africa, I didn't care where.
Uh-huh.
And I was willing to help all I could.
Well, it's your time, huh?
But it's too political now.
Really? Oh, dear.
At least I couldn't get any interest aroused in them.
Now, of course, the relief organizations that are assisting in famine areas.
Well, Ethiopia.
Are obviously using edible protein.
Yeah.
It's the most easily transportable and the most easily ingested, and it's, of course, it's rich in building block. Substances and amino acids. Who's producing that for this effort? Which company?
I really don't know.
Of course, there are all kinds of But isn't that the basic form of sustenance for famine?
That's right.
Ridden countries.
It could easily be. Compounded right on the spot, you might say, into edible end products for these poor people that are starving from lack of protein.
Now, in other words, the soybean is not necessarily the savior of.
It happens to be the most economical right at the moment,
but
there are literally any seed is a potential source of protein.
Really?
Any seed.
Uh-huh.
See, the soybean is a seed.
Right.
So is the peanut and so forth.
Right. So really, the potential is really unlimited in terms of we really don't have to have starving people, right?
That's right. And Purina is probably on the right track in building their basic edible protein plants like they are. And all the time they're improving this flavor deal. It's getting better all the time. And
There's always been a drawback. People starving will eat it, but they don't like it.
That's right.
Yeah.
They'd rather starve, actually. We sent, at the end of World War II over in Italy, when they were so short of food, they sent a government, I don't know, hundreds of tons of soy flour.
Yeah.
And people wouldn't eat them. They starved.
They wouldn't eat
they
it?
They wouldn't eat it.
Why? Because they'd never...
It tasted terrible.
Oh, you still hadn't refined your taste technology.
Yeah. Yeah. It just rotted there on the docks.
Oh, my God. And yet they were starving.
Mm-hmm.
They could have made bread.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Well,
well, like
it was flour,
And then baking goods, but India, there's activity in India too. I forgot about that.
Oh yeah, fertile.
Yeah.
In what way? What kind of activity?
Well, I wouldn't doubt about there's some protein plants being built.
Okay. Good. By who?
Well, by the English government, I think.
Okay. All right.
They grow a lot of peanuts over there too.
In India,
yeah.
Perfect climate for it.
Yeah.
It's strange that Unilever backed out. Did you ever find out why?
Well, yeah, they're peanut.
Oh, they couldn't get the peanut growing in North Africa, but they could have gotten it somewhere.
They had this contract, which I think was a chain around their neck.
Oh. What contract?
The English government to manage this big peanut protein in Africa for the
plantation.
British government.
Okay, yeah.
It was a big deal.
Oh, it was.
But they would have to bring the peanuts down about 100 miles to the port.
Oh.
And this was all done on native barebacks. I mean, a 100-pound bag of...
Right.
What turned out was, and this ruined their plant up, they would ship the stuff up to Port Sunlight near Liverpool, where they had this big plant.
Well, that was their name, wasn't it?
Yeah, Port Sunlight. Wonderful place.
Yeah.
The natives would start out with a bag half full of peanuts, and then as they'd get down toward the docks, they'd fill them with rocks and anything else that was heavy.
When
dead animals and that kind of stuff.
Oh,
so the stuff arriving up at Port Sunlight, half of it was so putrid by that time that just...
You mean they would do it in order to increase the weight?
Yeah, they were supposed to deliver 100 pounds in a bag, and you know, that was... They'd have to march about 100 miles, as
I
was told.
Peanuts are a lot lighter than rocks and dead animals, weren't they?
Yeah.
Why would they do that?
Well, just they would start out with only about half as many peanuts as they should. And they,
oh, I see.
And it was, they told me, 100 miles sometimes.
Well, it's their own fault for having an antiquated transportation system.
Well, they're still working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what's the most popular source of edible protein that the companies are using?
Soy.
Soy, yeah. Still soy, that's the best.
Well, it's the most economical.
Most economical, mm-hmm. Yeah. Peanuts haven't really come along.
No, they could in this country, but the peanut farmer is pretty good, but peanuts are a little expensive yet compared to soy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I once visited the Central Soy plant in Fort Wayne for the office, and how do they figure into this whole scheme?
Well, they well, Central Soy bought the Archer Daniels protein plant, which was located in Chicago.
That was a large bulk protein processing plant, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Largely from soybeans.
Yeah, all from soybeans.
All from soybeans.
But it was a solvent extraction plant rather than an expeller.
Mm. It threw the sludge away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't salvage it. No.
But they were trying to make protein for paper coating.
Yeah, right. These were industrial.
And Central Soy bought it because they were using the oil in their paints,
mm-hmm.
and they thought they didn't know what to do with the protein, but they wanted it anyway.
Sure.
And the plant blew up on them, but they did rebuild. That's the one that.
The one you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
because of the spark igniting
But they remained in the soy protein business all these years, inedible protein.
Inedible soy. So Central Soy is not edible protein.
It is now, but it wasn't.
It wasn't then. Okay.
It doesn't amount to much even now, but
really?
They do produce it.
They do.
Yeah.
Now I had the idea that they were supplying, say, people like Kellogg's. You remember Kellogg experimented with a product called corn soya?
Yeah.
And I thought maybe Central Soy was supplying them with the soya part of that.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
You remember? I don't.
I remember the product.
I don't think they do it anymore. I don't think.
They don't make it. No, they learned they couldn't sell soy.
Even though they put corn with it and they
it was a pretty good product. Yeah.
Whatever they put
I liked it, really.
Did you?
Yeah.
You ate it?
Yeah, we went through the plant once, and they served it then afterwards.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
After you'd retired, or?
No, I was still working at Ford then.
Oh, I see. You went through as a visitor, as a researcher?
Well,
visiting
scientist. I asked to go through the plant, and they said, sure, we'll come on up, and we'll take you through.
They were a fairly pioneering effort
in soy
cereal.
They had a very active research department.
Did they? Mm-hmm. Oh, in Battle Creek?
Yeah.
Well, I was growing up at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Okay, good.
But
we used to go through it all the time to get those free cereals, and I'm sure I ate corn and soya.
Yeah.
Do you know that Gary Moore, who was a very popular entertainer for many years, was sponsored by at one point by Kellogg's corn soya, and he had a little jingle that he used to say, "Corn soya, oh boy, how I enjoy ya in the foyer." I never forgot that.
But they had a hard time marketing it.
It
wasn't a bad product, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They eventually gave it up.
Yeah.
Which is too bad.
Mm-hmm.
So Central Soy was really largely in the industrial application of us. Mm-hmm.
And when I went to first went to Swift,
mm-hmm.
We approached Central Soy to see if they would produce an edible protein suitable for our purposes,
right.
And they agreed to try to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I gave them my thoughts on how to do it and so forth, and they went into the business and have been in it ever since.
Yeah.
And they have an active industrial or an edible protein plant.
What products are they producing?
I think it's because of the filler for the meat.
It's filler mostly. Yeah. It's bulk products.
Yeah.
They're not marketing something.
No end products. No.
I see. What companies are marketing recognizable brands that use a edible soy protein?
Well, there's thousands of small localized meat companies.
Mm-hmm.
Every city has a lot of them.
Right.
And that's meat, where the big market is.
Meat processing companies.
Now, Oscar Mayer, for instance, they would hesitate to dilute anything in their hot dogs or anything like that. They might put out a meat loaf or something, but they would never touch their hot dog formula.
Really? So they don't use soy extenders? Or
no, well, not very much.
Okay.
They may have some obscure products that do, but
nothing
that's a well-known brand name.
Right.
And Swift wouldn't do it either for their hot dogs. But they seriously considered, you know, in something like deviled ham, that they could do that.
Yes, yes. Now there is a deviled ham on the market. It's been on for years. The only one that makes
Underwood.
Now, what is the composition of their deviled ham?
It's all real ham ground up.
Yeah. They don't use the soy. Yeah.
This is why Swift got into that. It just irked the dickens out of them that Underwood, this little dinky Underwood company, dominated this deviled ham market. And no matter what Swift did, they couldn't touch their sale. And it just irked the dickens out of them. And
I've tried that. It's salty as hell.
Yeah, it is. Oh, they load it up with salt.
Yeah.
And fat and everything.
Yeah. God,
so we could make a superior product with the fiber.
And that would be more healthy.
Yeah, but they had that meat conflict.
You know, it sounds like Swift were a little timid. They'd lost the sausage casing invention that they could have had probably for a song.
They were so big and of course so set in their ways, that they...
Inflexible, old line company. Yeah. They've done it ever since their German great-grandfathers done in Germany. Yeah. Incredible. And then they passed up the deviled ham market.
Well, they were seriously considering marketing that when the other side went out. Animal relations groups that don't touch it, get it out of the way.
Would it have been unethical for them to market it without saying? Was the Food and Drug Commission so strong that they couldn't have? They would have to say imitation meat product.
Yeah,
they would.
Yeah, it was
okay. And they would have listed ingredients.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
We still don't know how to market these products, and we're probably 50 years ahead of the market. But as the population growth continues, it's got to come.
You've got the taste, Lake.
Well, it's getting better all the time. I'm not sure you'd say it's
MIT late. Runs a taste laboratory.
Yeah, they'll evaluate new products for industry.
You mean
for a $15,000 fee, they'll...
You mean research?
They'll
get a panel of tasters together and they'll rate them?
That's right.
That's
they even they can even go further than that. They say that you'll need...
Shadings.
Right? Yeah.
Uh-huh. What kind of products will they taste? Or a taste test or market research?
I knew some company that used them all the time. Forgotten who it was right now.
Somebody who's in the imitation food business.
Yeah, I can't recall. when I was first trying to sell my patent, I went to MIT because I knew they were active in foods. So I took a prototype like pork chop or something, and they actually tasted it, and they said, "Well, your texture's all right, but your flavor is no good."
Really? You try to smoke and Well, this is supposed to be cooked pork chops. That's what you were simulating, not a raw pork chop. Obviously.
Yeah, it was white, cooked to color.
So it had to be kind of gray or...
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it wouldn't be pink, Fascinating, just fascinating. You know, when I was a kid in Battle Creek, I used to see these they called it the Battle Creek Food Company.
Yeah.
And it was a spin-off of the old sanitarium.
That's right.
Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, the stuff that he's fed to his patients, because he was a vegetarian. Of course, the Seventh-day Adventists were too.
Worthington finally bought him,
Oh, did they buy out Battle Creek food?
Mm-hmm.
They did, huh?
Yeah.
What year? When was that?
Oh, about 58 or so, somewhere in that area.
They lasted that long. And I can remember going up to the West End where the sanitarium was, which is not the end either, and I can remember the marketing arm of this company would have their products displayed in a walk-by window.
Yeah.
And they would have soy loin, they called it, I think mm-hmm. they patented that name. They would have soy burgers.
Yeah.
They would have soy dogs, soy hot dogs. They would have soy fillets, steak, simulated steak, and they would have, oh God, all kinds of, and I used to say to myself, who in God's name eats this stuff? Because I've never been a vegetarian. I've never even wanted to be a vegetarian, although I eat a lot of vegetables now that I'm getting to the point where I have to, but a lot of fiber, but at that time I couldn't imagine anyone eating a soy, an imitation steak.
That was all based on wheat gluten.
Was it really? Mm-hmm. Was that their base?
Yeah, and also it was Worthington's original base till they got into fiber.
But I think they called it soy loin.
Yeah.
At least that name was a catchy catchphrase. But it was all wheat gluten.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Worthington too?
Worthington first was until they got into fiber.
Okay.
And they bought Battle Creek and retained the name and some of their products. Mm-hmm. They eliminated some of the others. And they had a lady research director up there. I've forgotten her name. She was very nice.
Where was Worthington again?
Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio.
Worthington, Ohio, actually.
Worthington, Ohio. Okay, yeah.
And they brought this lady down and worked in their laboratory at Worthington mm-hmm. until she retired. She was quite elderly.
She was their research chemist?
She was for Battle Creek.
Oh, they brought her down from Battle Creek?
Yeah.
Do you remember her name?
No, but
she knew you.
I should know her.
There a lot, then.
I should know, yeah. I visited her up there in her laboratory a couple times.
In Battle Creek?
Yeah.
In the West End, so you know where
it
was. Okay, good, yeah.
It was an old factory building. It was a real old building.
Where was it? Do you remember?
It was sort of out of town. I drove out there.
Oh, it was out of town, okay. I was talking about the retail outlet.
No, I'm talking about their factory.
Okay, fine, yeah. That's incredible. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you have any last words to
One thing that I seems to me should be stressed is the soybean has turned out to be our number two cash crop and also our second largest earner of foreign trade money.
Mm-hmm.
And that really started from Ford.
Just
see, when we first started in 1931, hardly anybody ever heard of soybeans.
Right.
And Ford's penchant
Ford.
For publicity.
Henry Ford.
Publicized the soybean.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't think we added particularly important stuff technically to the soybean industry, but he certainly made it popular and made people become aware of it.
Right.
So today, it's so darn important.
That he be remembered as the father of the soybean.
Yeah.
Of the commercial utilization.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I always thought that it would be nice if they would rebuild the laboratory or restore it like it was when we were doing that soybean work,
yes.
And give it the real credit that it deserves, instead of treating it like last time I saw it was this, it was a receiving or storage
shipping and receiving. And now it's going to be the ticket office for the railroad, which has been moved over to accommodate the Firestone Farm.
Well, they're missing a bet. I mean, if they're trying to enhance Ford's reputation, that would be one way to do it. I think when he died, the rest of the family just wanted no part of any of his pet projects and wiped them out.
Exactly, that's what happened.
Wiped them out.
Right. Yeah, they completely eradicated the old Ford company. It was the new Ford company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all of his interests and hobbies and special enthusiasms were completely
gone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's too bad.
Yes,
because he was really the benefactor of the farmer in many ways. Yeah. The tractor, of course, as you know. The Model T was a utilitarian vehicle most attracted to farmers and most used by them. His feeling, as you so eloquently mentioned, of the welfare of the farmer. But I agree with you wholeheartedly that something should be done to memorialize
his
great interest and enthusiasm in converting the soybean into the miracle substances today.
Yeah, there was an article, A Miracle Bean or something.
That's right. Right, yeah, I've forgotten that.
But it's coming. It's just, it seems to me he should be getting the credit.
He certainly should be, yes. Maybe we can do something about it.
Well, I hope so.
On the time remaining, Mr. Boyer, I want to go back to a subject which we just barely touched on. The Kammergic movement per se, it may not have been called that, but the utilization of surplus farm vegetables processed in some way to utilize not only the fact that they were surplus, but to extract from them whatever usable substance could be,
right,
be extracted. Where did that get its start outside of the impetus that you, Mr. Ford, gave?
Well, one example, it's not the only one, but one I remember, was the Quaker Oats Company developed a process for producing furfural from... Well, it's a chemical like phenol.
Can you spell it?
F-U-R-F-U-R-A-L.
Okay.
But it came from the oat hulls.
The oat hulls, mm-hmm. Okay, which were largely usually discarded.
That's right.
Right, when the oats were milled.
It was the first publicized development of a Kammergic nature.
Okay.
And it was strictly a Kammergic development.
A chemical compound coming from...
Coming from a waste oil. Agricultural
right.
source.
Right, okay. So, now that was what, in the late 20s, early 30s, or even earlier? Huh?
I first heard of it in the late 20s.
Did you? Mm-hmm. That was a rather sensational development. Huh?
Yes, it was, because plastics were just beginning to be talked about, and you're getting well known.
You thought about it.
And furfural, we were hoping, or the Quaker Oats would replace phenol for a lot of these plastic.
Phenol had been the mainstay.
Yeah.
And that's distilled from coal tar.
Well, yeah, that's one of them. Of course, they can make it synthetic now too, but
they couldn't then.
No. Yeah. But that's the first case that I am aware of where it was a good example of it.
Were there others that followed then?
Well, there probably were that I'm not aware of. But of course, the soybean took over all our time and efforts, and it was a good starting point for Kammergic products.
Now, there, of course, maybe I'm way ahead of you here, but the fact that they the hull was discarded on most grains, was it not?
Mm-hmm.
It was the heart, the wheat germ, the heart of the grain. And so were there other grain hulls that were utilized in that way?
Well, we tried it, of course, on soy hulls, and
we didn't
get a yield.
Okay. So how, in what other ways?
Corn cobs was one.
Yeah.
But so it never became commercially.
What sort of substance did you, or what sort of fluid did you, or liquid did you get from corn hulls?
Well, they were trying to get furfural again.
Oh, yeah, okay, good, yeah. So the Kammergic movement is beginning to coalesce in the early 30s, and then you and Mr. Ford come along, and what happened then?
Well,
of course, the makeup of the council are largely, and you were also, were you not sponsored by the American Chemical Association or
Society?
American Chemical Society.
It was a different organization.
But it was the public relations arm of the chemical industry, was it not?
Yeah, the Chemical Foundation.
That's it.
And I'm trying to think of the man that headed it up because I knew him quite well. Well, when we had our first convention there in Dearborn, he was very prominent.
So how did this idea of a Kammergic council take form in the early 30s?
I think it was the Chemical Foundation, and there was a magazine published in Philadelphia called the Country Gentleman or something
yes.
like that.
Yes, very popular.
And they got behind the idea and pushed
did
it.
They?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the president of that one, I can't recall his name right now, spoke at our meeting
uh-huh.
in Dearborn.
Right.
And of course.
Now, well, but let's go back. The movement is gathering steam. Was there someone like Mr. Hale who came along and?
Yes.
He played
a prominent part.
He was a chemist at Dow Chemical in Midland. And what was his full name again?
I think William J. Hale.
William J. Hale. Okay.
I think that's the way.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. So he does he approach you and Mr. Ford?
Yeah, I think he did that, and he had a meeting with Mr. Ford, and we're on our last side. We won't be much longer. And he sold Mr. Ford again, I think, on the potential of soybeans.
So Hale was the salesman.
Yeah, he was. That's the way he reached us.
And yes, there okay.
I visited him in Midland a couple of times. But
did you have a complimentary interest?
Well, yes. He was followed our work with soy, because I don't think Dow was doing anything on that line.
Okay.
But he was very much interested in himself in the work and followed it.
So he suggested, Mr. Ford, that you set up a national...
Well, he said, you're on the right track, keep going, that kind of stuff.
Okay,
you know.
Good. Yeah. So who really got the first Convergent Council together?
I would think the head of the
Chemical
Foundation.
Okay.
And how we got it to Dearborn, the Dearborn Inn had just been built.
Okay.
And
31.
Yeah. Somehow or other that got tied in, and that's why they decided to hold the conference there.
Yeah, And so were you asked to handle the organization?
Yeah, for instance, not the program necessarily, but had to make sure that all the food and all that sort of stuff was going to be all right.
So who set up the program and invited the participants? And set the subjects of the papers?
I believe that it was the editor of this Farm magazine in Philadelphia.
Oh, Country Gentleman.
I think that was the name of the magazine.
Uh-huh.
But he was very prominent in the Comergic field. Their names are probably in the record somewhere.
Okay, good.
The
man, I have the proceedings.
The Chemical Foundation, he was a real promoter too.
So you had these marvelous papers which were given, which largely dealt with, at one point it seemed to me that it dealt with the extraction of combustible fuels from waste vegetables.
Well, alcohol was, of course, the...
power alcohol.
That was a big deal in those days.
Yeah.
And George Granger Brown from the University of Michigan was on the program. You know, he's a very well-known chemical engineer.
Was he?
Yeah. He's head of the engineering department up there.
But he was also an enthusiast
of
for power
alcohol.
Fuels,
yeah.
For power alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. So that meant simply processing waste vegetables to extract a combustible alcohol.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was one. But what else? But that was one prominent feature. But what else were? What other subjects?
Well, I don't. Other than the soybean, I don't think there was anything that was outstanding. I believe Carver was in on this
a little bit. Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Supposedly George Washington Carver was invited by Mr. Ford to attend the first one.
I think so. And I think he was on the program.
Well, now he's not on the printed program.
Wasn't he? Okay.
But he may have been an added starter after the...
He did speak in Detroit, I think, at an ACS meeting once.
Yes, he did. Yeah, I think you're right. But Mr. Ford said, why don't you come out to our... come on, I'll get you a room at the Dearborn Inn and come to our... Were the sessions held at the Dearborn Inn, physically?
Some of them were.
Or were others held?
I don't know of any place else, but
must have been the Dearborn Inn.
The ballroom wasn't all that big, but...
Yeah. I wondered physically where they put you.
Must have been the ballroom there.
Did you use the theater in the Henry Ford Museum?
No.
Must have been the ballroom, yeah, right. Were they well attended? Do you remember how many people came?
300 sticks in my mind.
300.
I'm not sure.
There were chemists, scientists, chemical executives, interested people.
Yeah, there were enough names there, mm-hmm, that it attracted research directors from all types of industry.
I can imagine.
So,
well, were the proceedings financed? Did the publication of proceedings financed by Mr. Ford?
I wouldn't doubt it. I really don't know that.
And you think he allowed them to use the premises of the Dearborn
in free? Maybe I wasn't in on any of that.
Well, that was one big one. There was a second one in 36 as well.
Where?
In Dearborn.
Oh, was there?
There were two Comergic Council meetings in Dearborn. We had the proceedings.
Oh, dear. I don't remember.
And the second year was an extension of the first. Still a lot involved with power alcohol, at least that's high in everybody's...
well, that was, of course, the big market, big potential.
And of course, as you mentioned earlier, the tremendous surplus generated by the Depression and by the Roosevelt farm policies of subsidy farm generated a mountains of surplus vegetables, which people felt had to be utilized rather than just let rot or used as fertilizer or silage or whatever. But so there was a second one, and there was also a third one. We had a much smaller conference. We had the proceedings, and they're bound in the same...
In Dearborn?
No, the same distinctive orange binding and the same printing, but it was in Florida. I think it may have been in Gainesville at the University of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
That's a much smaller one. The proceedings are much smaller.
Yeah.
William J. Hale wrote two popular books on the Cambridge movement, I think. One was called Farmward March. Have you ever seen that one?
That starts to ring a bell.
And another one with another euphoric title, which escapes me at the moment. And I suspect they were rather well received. They weren't bestsellers, probably, but he sent signed copies to Mitch Ford, which we have. And it seemed like it was a very enthusiastic public relations gung-ho approach.
Yeah.
He may have popularized it. Did the Cambridgic movement as a movement die a bit toward the end of the 30s?
Yeah.
It did.
Just sort of...
Sort of petered out.
Of course, the oncoming war sort of took over.
Anyway, they needed all those vegetables to feed people.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was no... The surplus was diminishing. And there was no real problem. Mm-hmm. And of course, after the war, it went on into more sophisticated channels.
Yeah.
Farm subsidies have always been a problem in this country because most administrations do subsidize farmers. And I guess the second Reagan administration, is the first to threaten to cut farmer subsidies. Just
it's going to be a touchy subject.
Well, this has been fabulous, Mr. Boyer. We've got a little time left. Is there anything that you would like to say further about Mr. Ford's interest and support of this incredible saga?
Well, of course, I was fortunate in being so close to him,
right?
And sort of being like, I suppose, a protege or something. But
right, a son, maybe.
We did spend a lot of time together, and.
What's your personal impression of Mr. Ford?
Well, when you were on the good side of him, he
was great.
Uh-huh. And
he couldn't do enough for him.
I know that some of the people at Rouge Plant that he didn't like lived in fear that they'd run into him someday. And
he'd say, "You're still here."
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, he did have his vindictive and side.
And he was, I think he got a kick out of playing one man against another.
Right.
And it's like he said, "Now don't tell Charlie about our project here," and that kind of stuff. But he was, I wouldn't say we'd call him a deep thinker. Mr. Cameron, William J. Cameron, I knew him quite well.
Did you?
Yeah. And I used to go up to him and that, you know, for advice and things like that.
Sure, sure.
But I think Mr. Ford probably wasn't as deep a thinker as Cameron was, but he used Cameron. He knew he knew just how to get his strong points. And Chris, he was a good engineer, sound engineer, basically.
Yes, right.
And we
intuitive.
He did.
He may not have had formal training, but he had an awful lot of on-the-job training.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the ground up.
We, one of the other things that touched on Dr. Ruddiman's work was in our efforts to find a type of bean that would not have the bad taste.
Rancid taste.
Yeah. There's several varieties of green soybeans. They're green when they're ripe.
Right.
And they were the ones that most of the companies tried to use for, say, with canned beans or something like that.
Right.
And Dr. Edelman did develop some very pretty good tasting products mm-hmm. out of green soybean.
Mm.
And so Mr. Ford said, well, let's build a canning plant. And sure enough, we put in a complete canning plant somewhere right. over on the Ford estate.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it was on the outskirts of Ford
yeah.
estate, not inside the
yeah.
limits. It was an old building, that wooden building that Ford owned, and he said, well, let's put it in here. So we built a complete canning line of where we'd blanch the green beans and cook them, can them, pressure cook them and all that.
Is that in the late 30s, early 40s?
It must have been in the time when Dr. Edelman was trying to develop food product.
It wasn't one of the stone buildings, it was a wooden building.
It was a wooden building.
Like a large
barn,
maybe.
Yep. Okay. Ford liked to utilize what was available, you know. And
mm-hmm.
and then when the, when the war threatened, we saw we were going to have to close down, and he gave that equipment, the whole plant, to Michigan State University. Dr. Charles Hanna, I guess, was the
yeah.
president at the time.
Yeah.
He came down, and Mr. Ford made a present of this complete canning line.
And what did they utilize it for?
Well, for teaching canning to students, I suppose.
The canning process?
Yeah.
Didn't
have to use soybeans, they could use anything.
All the technical machinery was there?
It was there, yeah. It was amounted to quite a lot of money in those days. But that's another aspect of Mr. Ford's.
Just incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, you've had the best possible career, I think.
Yeah.
Most exciting.
I was always lucky to be on the good side of them.
Yes. Did you ever catch the bad side of me?
Not as far as I'm concerned. He did